Welcome to the CSIS Kajet Asia podcast, where we think deeply and reflect on policy in Asia. I'm your host, Colin Quinn. If you like what you hear today, make sure to subscribe to our weekly podcast on iTunes or through our RSS feed. And we'll start, as we always do, with the region's news. In Hong Kong this week, the legislature voted down a political reform plan proposed by the Chinese Communist Party. The plan would have introduced universal suffrage to Hong Kong in 2017, but was structured to ensure that no candidates critical of its rule would ever be allowed to stand for chief executive. Pro-Beijing lawmakers walked out minutes before the vote, allowing the pro-democracy group within the legislature to vote it down with ease. In North Korea, a severe drought that could lead to an escalating food shortage is being reported by state news agencies. A number of large rice-growing paddies have withered and died from lack of rain. The notable public announcement of any domestic problem is rare in North Korea and may signal Pyongyang seeking external aid, with the drought being described as the worst in a century. In New Delhi, India's finance minister Arun Jaitley is headed to the US for a 9-day trip aimed at attracting investment and assuaging concerns about India's tax regime. He's set to visit New York, Washington DC and San Francisco. Meanwhile, the Asian Development Bank announced plans to increase lending to India by 50% to a total of $12 billion by 2018. The loans are set to finance key infrastructure projects. In Japan, officials are struggling to determine the best next steps for 16 tons of reprocessed plutonium put on hold in France. While Japan debates its future use of nuclear energy after the Fukushima disaster, the country is unable to take fuel made from the plutonium because its reactors are shut down. Areva, the French company holding the material, has long-standing contracts with Japanese utilities and is currently facing billions of dollars in losses. Japan will be required to find a new destination for the fuel. And that's the news for this week. Next week, the 7th edition of the US-China Strategic and Economic Dialogue will take place in Washington, D.C. CSIS's Kajet Asia editor, Jeffrey Bean, sat down with CSIS Freeman Chair in China Studies, Christopher Johnson, to take stock of the relationship between the US and China amid considerable friction and preview the upcoming Strategic and Economic Dialogue.
Today, I'm joined by Chris Johnson, the Freeman Chair in China Studies here at CSIS and Senior Advisor, to discuss the upcoming strategic and economic dialogue here in Washington, D.C. between the United States and China. This is the 7th edition of the dialogue. Can you give us a snapshot right now of what U.S.-China relations look like in your view?
Absolutely. I think the relationship is generally stable. What's been interesting in the recent weeks and months is that certainly there's been a lot of commentary that's been coming out suggesting that U.S.-China relations are variously at a tipping point or have already shifted into sort of a confrontational mode. There's been a lot of writing by our think tank colleagues and other commentators, media and so on, looking at this issue. And it's been striking to me. I just come back from Beijing, and in China there's a lot of concern about this. They believe that to some degree, seeing these articles and reports that have been written, they're wondering, is there a massive and fundamental debate within the U.S. over the trajectory of U.S.-China relations? And has the sort of pattern of engagement over the 30 years, is that being called into question? And some are asking that it should be, and sort of saying that maybe a more robust response from the United States is required. And this has China sort of wondering where the U.S. is going. My own view is that in the larger context, the relationship is stable. We have challenges, certainly, and one of the big challenges is making sure that some of the security issues, which often are the most intractable, and by those I think we can talk mainly about maritime and cybersecurity, are kind of rearing their ugly head in a way that both sort of poisons the atmosphere potentially for the strategic and economic dialogue, and certainly should be considered worrisome by both parties with President Xi Jinping about to pay a state visit here later in the fall.
What should we expect on the SNED agenda? Last time President Obama and Xi got together, we heard about the climate agreement, which was somewhat of a surprise. And so what should we anticipate on the agenda, and what sort of deliverables, if any, do you expect?
I think probably the main focus for both parties is to sort of try to see if they can, if you will, filter out some of the noise that I just mentioned, and to send a sort of strong signal that the relationship is stable and moving in the right direction, and that we are working cooperatively together on issues. Something I heard a lot about when I was in Beijing is that basically whatever deliverables the Chinese might have traditionally been thinking about delivering in sort sort of a SNED context, they're probably going to hold on to until the summit, unfortunately, at this stage. So really, I think the main way to think about the SNED process this year is as a table setter for the upcoming summit. And do they do a good job, the two sides, of, if you will, sort of pressing the reset button and trying to calm nerves about the status of their relationship? I think there'll be a lot of focus on that. Obviously, issues of maritime security, issues of cybersecurity, the bilateral investment treaty certainly will be probably the main focus in the economic track. But my understanding is that progress on that is slow, possibly glacial at this point. The Chinese have provided a sort of negative list that is not welcome. It's too long. It has a lot of problems with it. And this is going to be a tough fight. It's going to take several years to be able to negotiate this. But at least the two sides are showing interest and a willingness to try to slog through what will be those very difficult negotiations. So I think expectations should be kept low for what we're going to see coming out of this. But that doesn't mean that it's not a good thing to have those senior level leaders exchanging views and interchanging, especially before our two presidents sit down.
You discussed the noise, the friction points that exist both on the commercial side and the security side of the relationship. As you mentioned, this visit is largely seen as a table setter for President Xi's state visit to the United States to meet with Obama later this fall. Conventional wisdom would suggest that you don't want to rock the boat too much ahead of that type of engagement among the senior leadership, particularly on the Chinese side. But as you outlined, the boat is rocking pretty heavily right now. Do you think the SNED is the right vehicle to manage the relationship for the United States at this point?
It's challenging. I mean, I think the SNED faces a lot of challenges, some of which are like any other sort of dialogue like that. There's a tendency toward bureaucratic drift. Oftentimes, they're established for a particular purpose. You know, it's important to remember that the SNED is an evolution of the original SED, the Strategic Economic Dialogue. And the original theory behind it was that the two leaders who were then meeting, which were Hank Paulson and his counterpart in China when Hank Paulson was Treasury Secretary, was to talk about very forward-leaning long-range economic issues. And now we've devolved to a situation where on the economic track, it's increasingly hard to distinguish between the economic track of the SNED and the JCCT that comes every year at the end of the year, which is much more focused on straight commercial and trade matters. And so you have a situation where you have two bureaucracies that come together that need to provide deliverables for their leadership. And so there's a tendency for the approach to become very bureaucratized. I think part of the challenge as well is that the match, if you will, between the personalities and the portfolios between the two leaders on each side is not as good as it was, frankly, in the previous iteration. In the previous iteration, you had Tim Geithner, who was a very sort of internationalist-looking person, knew the Chinese well, had studied Chinese and so on, and Wang Qishan on the Chinese side, who also had long experience with the United States. And likewise, Dai Bingguo, the former state counselor, and Secretary Clinton, who knew each other. There was some sort of good interaction there. Now we have a situation where we have Wang Yang, the vice premier on the Chinese side, not an economic guy by training, does not hold the financial portfolio, which is a really big deal given that his counterpart is the U.S. Treasury Secretary. And you have Jack Lew on our side, who is not necessarily an international guy, more of a domestic guy by orientation. So the fit isn't quite as good as it was. And then we have what we're seeing with Xi Jinping sort of changing how decision-making is getting done inside the Chinese system. And it's not these type of mechanisms that are making decisions. It's the shift toward the party, you know, as the sort of lead decision maker, and these new leading groups that he set up that are making decisions. So it's interesting in that, you know, here you have a very senior Politburo member, vice premier on the Chinese side, and it's not exactly clear how empowered he is to make decisions. And that's certainly true for his counterpart, State Councilor Yang Jiechi, on the strategic track side.
Chris Johnson, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Jeff.
And that was Christopher Johnson. We turn now to the South Korean government's response to the outbreak of Middle East Respiratory Syndrome, or MERS. I sat down with Daniel Lucy, a public health physician at the Georgetown University Medical Center and worldwide leading expert on MERS, to discuss the pandemic and weigh in on what lessons can be learned from South Korea's response as cases are cropping up in Thailand and Hong Kong. Dr. Lucy, obviously in Asia there's been a number of outbreaks throughout the years, avian flu, SARS. What makes this Middle East Respiratory Syndrome outbreak different?
Well, thank you for having me here today at CSIS, Kwame. I appreciate it. So you're right, avian flu is very serious and has been in Asia since 1997, the first form, H5N1, and then there's another one since 2013, H7N9 in China. Certainly SARS, everyone remembers very, very well from 2003. But now the Middle East Respiratory Syndrome, or MERS, has caused an outbreak in Korea. It's not the first country that at least one patient has been found in Asia to have MERS, Malaysia and Philippines previously, and today Thailand announced the first case of MERS in Bangkok. But as you know, there is a significant sized outbreak in Korea. I think today up to approximately 165 patients, of whom 23 have died. So like avian flu and SARS, MERS is very serious. Similarly to those two viruses, MERS virus predominantly affects the lungs, since the name respiratory syndrome. And also, like those two diseases, it has a high fatality rate. In other words, the percent of people that get infected and become sick, a high proportion of them, unfortunately, die.
What is the danger of infection for the general public?
Well, right now, I would say in Korea, and over the past 3 years of experience with this virus in the Middle East, since it was first discovered in 2012 in Saudi Arabia and in Jordan, there hasn't been, fortunately, any widespread or sustained spread within the general population. Doesn't mean it couldn't happen, but it hasn't happened so far, including in Korea. But I think that that's really the fact that it hasn't spread in the general population of Korea is a credit to the public health and medical and government authorities who have responded to the outbreak in a very vigorous manner after perhaps somewhat of a slow start before it was recognized that there was an outbreak of MERS. So if the measures that haven't been put in place to control the outbreak, that so far for pretty much all 165 patients has been linked to multiple hospitals in Korea, then it could get into the general population. But it's been contained, it's been controlled, and it hasn't gotten into the general population.
And talk a bit about the measures that Korea has taken to control this.
So my understanding from reading the reports from World Health Organization and from the Ministry of Health, daily updates from Korea and other sources, including friends in Korea, there are multiple, and there should be multiple measures put into place and maintained until well after the last patient is recognized with MERS. So some of them, for example, focus on the care of the individual patient who has the illness, who has MERS pneumonia. So that patient needs to be given supportive oxygen if they need that, fluids because they get dehydrated easily. If there's any secondary bacterial infections, then antibiotics, but because this is a virus infection, antibiotics won't help at all to treat the MERS virus itself. In addition, the patient with MERS has to be treated in an isolation room in a hospital so that they don't expose anyone else to the virus. And the healthcare providers who take care of the patient need to wear appropriate, what we call personal protective equipment, or PPE, that's known to work for MERS, just like there's a different type of PPE or personal protective equipment for Ebola that we learned about last year and still this year in West Africa. In addition to the individual patient, there are measures to control the spread of the virus to people who are exposed to the patient before he was recognized or she was recognized to have the infection. And those generally focus on the control measure of quarantine, which really, it can sound like a scary word, but it really shouldn't be scary in practice. In other words, basically, if I've been exposed to someone with MERS, but I'm not sick, and it's been less than 14 days, which is the maximum amount of time after I'm exposed until I might get sick, then I need to be put into quarantine, which basically means that I need to be not around many other people in case I do get sick and then become contagious to other people. But it doesn't mean that I'm put into a room by myself with no food or water. No, not at all. I need to have everything that I normally need to have in terms of my health, and then be, in addition, closely monitored in case I'd get a fever or any trouble with my breathing, then immediately I can be transferred to a hospital and given care.
And Thailand, obviously, today has encountered its first case of MERS. Is there anything that Thailand can learn from the Korean case to deal with this issue now?
Yes, I'm sure that the Thailand health officials and medical officials I believe there's one particular hospital, the name of which I don't know, I haven't seen disclosed yet, in Bangkok where the patient is. I'm sure they have been following what's been going on in Korea since May with the MERS outbreak, and hopefully they will have learned lessons about the care of the individual patient, quarantine of people who are exposed, not having people travel out of the country, out of Thailand, that is, that they're supposed to be in quarantine in the country, and hopefully lessons also about transparency and announcing information as early as possible. So today they did that one patient, and I think they said approximately 59 or 60 people already in quarantine. And now over the next, approximately 14 days, I'm sure that everyone will be waiting to see if there's any additional patients with MERS in Thailand.
Well, it's something we'll have to keep an eye on. Dr. Lisi, thanks for joining
us. Thank you so much, Colm. Pleasure.
And that was Dan Lucy. That's our show for this week. You can always find more at cogitasia.com and csis.org, and check out our island tracker and maritime specific analysis accessible through the Asia Maritime Transparency Initiative, or AMTI, microsite. I'm Colm Quinn. Thanks for listening.